You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189 by Rudolf Steiner, titled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy and the Social Question, 8 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 15th of March, 1919. If you attentively examine human history, you will find a certain theme running through it. A characteristic reluctance to focus thoughts on what is being asked by the clearly audible realities unfolding in the world. In general, people are disinclined to consider ideas that do not run on well-worn tracks. But perhaps there has never been a time when this was so apparent, when people were so averse to entertaining ideas they had never previously considered. There's an underlying phenomenon running through history which has come to the fore today particularly. I have spoken a good deal about how this manifested several years back. If you think back to the spring and early summer of 1914, you could compile a fine collection of speeches by European statesmen, all with a similar theme. Foreign Secretary Jagow, for instance, gave a speech in the German Parliament to the effect that efforts made by European governments have succeeded in creating good relationships between the great powers in Europe, and peace is therefore assured for long ages to come. The same thought, with slight variations, was expressed by all these pragmatists, in quotes, as they like to think of themselves. Well, that was back then. And only a few weeks later the conflagration erupted, culminating in the present disaster. What are we now witnessing in the stated aims and measures proposed by people who belong so thoroughly to their time? In the last few days I have heard various things figuring in the League of Nations conference in Bern. Despite the variety of themes that were raised there, everything said about the shape of things to come was more or less of like kind with the speeches made by European statesmen in the spring and early summer of 1914. These people think along well-worn tracks and say the same things they have always been accustomed to saying. Really, they have learned nothing, and I mean nothing, of the lessons of the past 4.5 years, which have been audibly speaking to us from the depths of world existence. This is something that a spiritual scientist particularly must attend to very keenly. A desolation has spread across large swathes of the European continent. Despite the many variations of message, it seems highly typical. Merely something pushed to an extreme. If people are talking of a worldview and a movement, which though it rises from subterranean depths of a kind calamitous for our era, will have great prospects of making strong headway, of securing great conquests simply because of the indifference, the lack of interest amongst the people of Europe. When I was very young, a long time ago now, our religious books sought to impress upon us children the nature of Christ Jesus by stating the following. He was, said these books, either a hypocrite, a fool, or what he himself stated, the Son of the living God. And since the assumption that he was either of the first two could not be countenanced, the only option was to believe that what he said was true, that he was indeed the Son of the living God. Well, this old argument, which I read in my religion books as a child, I heard again very recently in a talk that followed the League of Nations conference in Bern. The talk was given by Professor Uda of Graz University, and he said this: Jesus was either a hypocrite or a fool, or he was what he himself said, the Son of the living God. And since, this professor exclaimed, you will not dare to call Christ a hypocrite or a fool, he can only have been what he said of himself, the Son of the living God. Close quote. He hurled these words into the audience with Jesuitical vehemence. And there can have been very few there who asked themselves the only meaningful question in response to such an utterance. How has this little saying, repeated to the faithful for centuries, helped prevent the ruin and calamity that has broken over our heads? Is there no feeling and awareness of the pointlessness of shouting such things into a crowd, and continuing to shout them after the world catastrophe we have witnessed, and everything contributing to it that has proven so palpably fruitless? I attended another talk, too, by the same professor, on the social question, and he did not refer even once in the whole talk to any possible remedy. From beginning to end, his lecture was just a kind of condemnation of various malpractices and bad habits, which do certainly exist today. And yet here, too, nothing has been learned from the sad events of the last 4.5 years. I cite this example rather than others, because Professor Uda's talks were by far the best of those given in Bern by many different figures. At least they were rooted in a world view, albeit one which, widely propounded today, will inevitably prove dangerous. The other talks testified to an inability on the part of the speakers to even raise themselves to some kind of world view or outlook on life. People's thinking has become dull and short-sighted, and we must keep stressing this fact. They are unable to penetrate realities. They live in illusions, on the surface of things. It is hard to see how these speakers are actually contributing to the reshaping of the world so much needed today. My dear friends, we must keep reminding ourselves that over the past 4 centuries, European humanity, with its American offspring, has developed a form of thinking that can only grasp the dead and lifeless realm. We have come up with a thinking completely oriented to mathematics and technology. We have become incapable of directing our thoughts to what lives in the natural world. We only understand what is dead. The knowledge we can express about the organism in our official mainstream science only applies to the dead organism and is gained from a study of the corpse. And yet this same thinking, which has become customary, is now applied to the social organism as well. But this means only that a great proportion of humanity has become unable to form thoughts about the living social organism at all. At best, they find it very difficult to form such thoughts, much preferring the ease of reciting ad infinitum what has been drummed into them for centuries, like a catechism. Thoughts that run on well-worn tracks, or otherwise the offspring of these thoughts, now applied to the corpse of the living organism. But what is needed today, actually, is an understanding of the living social organism. Let's take something specific. Modern socialist thought, as I have described it in the past in all its aspects, rails extensively against capitalism. Socialism demands that all private capital be socialized, or, in other words, transferred to the means of production. The, in quotes, National Assembly in Weimar, as I believe it is called, has discussed this socialization extensively. But the very way in which people discuss capitalism today originates in the dead thinking of recent centuries, which has become a decisive aspect of the purely scientific, materialistic worldview. What we find here, my dear friends, is that capitalism has basically indeed become a terrible oppressor of the population at large. It will be hard to find many objections to everything that has been said and goes on being said by the proletarian movement against the oppressive nature of capitalism in terms of human rights and the economy. But what conclusion do socialist thinkers draw from this undeniable fact? They say that capitalism must therefore be abolished. It is, after all, oppressive, something dire. It has proved itself to be a scourge of modern humanity, and so must be abolished. What could be more comprehensible? What could seem more instrumental for campaigning purposes, though this has now led to dire unrest throughout Europe, than this demand for the abolition of capitalism? But for anyone who does not resort solely to the dead thinking of the past four centuries, and is instead able to invoke the living thinking that we need above all for our science of the spirit, this idea of abolishing capitalism, because it is a scourge and oppressor of humanity, is as logical as to say the following. We continually breathe in oxygen and breathe out dead carbon dioxide. Oxygen is transformed in us into carbon dioxide. So why even bother breathing it in? It just becomes death-delivering poison in us. And yet to live, we have to breathe it in. The living processes of the animal and human organism are inconceivable without breathing in oxygen. In the same way, the life of society is inconceivable without the continual creation of capital, especially today without the continual development of the means of production. And in reality, this is basically capital. There is no social organism that would not have to rely on the collaboration of individual human skills and capacities. If an understanding of the real needs of the social organism were to become widespread, the worker would recognize the need to trust in the director of an enterprise, would see that if the company director did not run the company, he, the worker, could not perform his work. That is entirely self-evident. But when there are company directors, it necessarily follows that capital accumulates. There simply is no way to avoid the accumulation of capital. So however well-meaning it might be to ask how capital can be abolished, the question is tantamount to asking how we could destroy the social organism altogether, how we might kill it off. It is perfectly apparent to anyone with any understanding of these things that capital accumulates in even the most sane and reasonable social order. And it is equally apparent that it is pointless to wonder how to prevent this, how to eradicate it. And yet people seem to find it too difficult to face this fact squarely. They'd rather not entertain such an idea. They want their thinking to be easy. Yet the times we live in will not allow us to make things easy for ourselves in this way. What people always forget is that all life is in growth and flux, that time is an element we need as we try to understand life, that living things are not fixed and constant but always changing. It is not difficult to recognize this, the part played by time in our understanding of life. After all, the human organism is alive. Consider the human organism, in fact, your own organism, at about 1:30 in the afternoon. You're all hard-working people who don't hang about too long in the cafeteria. And when you emerge from the cafeteria after lunch, then, all being well, you're not hungry for a while. Your organism is, I'm quite sure, a tangible human organism. And so, as you define it, at about 1:45 in the afternoon, as you emerge from the cafeteria, it is a living being, without hunger. But at 12:30, when you were going into the cafeteria, all of you were hungry, and so you might define the human organism at that point as one that feels hunger. Of course, you are considering specific actual life at two different moments in time. And you find that what this organism needs to thrive at these two different moments are opposing states that must be created in your organism. The first is a process necessary for the opposite to occur. This holds true both for natural organisms and social ones too. In the living social realm, we can never prevent capital arising as a self-evident phenomenon that accompanies the work of individual human capacities, as the development of property, of private property. If someone directs a branch of production and, quite justifiably, shares the yield of what is produced with the manual laborers who make it, the social organism simply could not survive without capital as an accompanying phenomenon. Capital owned by the individual just as he owns what he needs for his own use, and what he produces, which he then trades or exchanges to meet his own needs. Just as little as we could prohibit the eating of food because it is a nuisance to get hungry again after eating, so it is impossible to try to prevent capital being created at a particular time. Instead, we should think only about how this capital must be transformed in turn at a different moment in time. What should become of it? Unless you want to undermine the sustainability of the social organism, it is impossible to try to prevent the creation of capital. All you can try to do is assure that the capital which is created does not become harmful within the healthy social organism. It is only possible to realize this requirement, which is necessary for the healing of the social organism, in the threefold social organism. For only there, as in the natural human organism, can one sphere work in a contrary way to the other. It lies in an individual's interests that a sphere exists in the social organism in which individual human abilities come to expression. But equally, it lies in everyone's interests that these individual human capacities do not, over time, transform in a way that becomes harmful to the organism. In the economic cycle, capital will always be created. If you leave this capital circulating within the economic cycle, it leads to unlimited accumulation of wealth. You cannot allow the capital accumulating as a result of individual human abilities to remain an economic asset, but must rather transfer it into the rights sphere. You see, the moment a person obtains more for what he himself alone produces, or produces in common with others, than what he spends or consumes, his asset is truly no longer a commodity, any more than human labor can be one. Ownership of an asset is a right. Ownership, in fact, is nothing other than an exclusive right to use something, let's say land or property, and to exclude all others from holding such a right to it. No other definition of ownership is of use in understanding the social organism. And this means that the moment someone acquires ownership of something, this ownership is something that must be administered within the purely political state, within the rights sphere. But the state itself must not acquire it, for otherwise it becomes an economic player. Its role is only to transfer it to the spiritual organism, where people's individual abilities are administered. What I am describing only happens today with goods regarded as being the most paltry in economic value. For these it does happen, but not for valuable goods. If someone creates a spiritual product, let's say a major poem, an important work as a writer or an artist, he can bequeath the yield of this work to his descendants for a period of 30 years. After that, it is released from copyright and no longer passes to his descendants, but to all humanity. 30 years after the death of a writer, you can freely reprint his works. A really healthy idea underlies this. The idea that we owe what we possess as our individual gifts to all of society. Just as little as we could learn to speak human language on an isolated island with no human company, so we can only develop our individual gifts within society. These gifts are founded, of course, on our own karma, but they have to be developed through society, and so in a sense we owe them to society. They must return to society again. We only have custodianship of them for a certain period, for it is better for the social organism that we do hold this custodianship. This is because we ourselves are most intimate with what we have produced, and so can manage it best. These paltry values, as modern humanity sees them, are the spiritual ones, and so in a sense they are evaluated in social terms and governed by the idea of time. I have been told that some of my audience at a recent lecture in Bern, capitalists, apparently, were livid when I asked why a law couldn't be passed obliging the owners of capital, a certain number of years after their death, to relinquish their capital to the free governance of a body, a spiritual cultural organization, in the spiritual sphere of the social organism. There are, of course, many different ways of establishing a specific law. But people are outraged if you propose returning to the legal practice of ancient Hebrew times, when the distribution of goods was reallocated after a certain period. And what is the outcome of their outrage? That over the last 4.5 years, humankind has killed 10 million people and made 18 million people into cripples, and is now embarking on more such devastation. It is essential today to reflect on these things. It really does matter whether or not we invoke the idea of time when studying the social organism. People conceive of society in entirely atemporal terms when they say that this or that should happen with capital as it originates, in its status nascens. Yes, we must let capital emerge, and must let those who gave rise to it administer it for a while. But then we must be able to allow it to return again into the true commonality of humankind through a healthily functioning, that is, threefold, social organism. You can't ask why a single social organism could not accomplish all this too. People believe this, but to do so takes very poor account of the human psyche. We have to reckon with the human soul. Consider what happens if a judge is trying the case of a near or distant relative. He will have his personal feelings about this relative, but in issuing his judgment, he will not be guided by these feelings, but by the law, of course. His judgment will come from a different source. If you think through the psychology of this, you can see the need for people to judge from three different sources and administer from three different directions what flows together in the social organism. Our era is asking us to engage with such things, for it is the age of the consciousness soul, and this consciousness soul era needs people to base their actions on the guiding impulse of clear and specific ideas. Nowadays, many urge that we should relinquish reason and abstract thinking, the only kind of thinking they know about, and instead judge things more intuitively, and especially in matters relating to interpersonal relations, maintain a certain faith. They think that thinking is really only the preserve of science and academia. This is a questionable stance, because it is precisely in our era that people have developed faculties of extreme abstract thinking. They want to entertain only the most linear concepts, and having established them, they cling to them with huge tenacity. This abstract thinking is primarily of a kind that prioritizes only the human head, a thinking most of all bound to the physical organ of the head. Formerly, when atavistic clairvoyance still existed, this thinking faculty was imbued by a spiritually oriented thinking rising from the rest of the human organism. The time of atavistic clairvoyance is past, and now people must elevate themselves consciously and intentionally to imaginations, must consciously encompass the life of spirit. If they do not, people's thoughts will remain empty. As you know from our recent reflections, the head we bear on our shoulders today is in fact the rest of the organism, apart from the head, that belonged to us during our last incarnation. I have often spoken of this. The formative forces of the head, naturally not its physical substance, whose roundness is created in the image of the cosmos, pass over into the cosmos. The forces that accompany our life between death and rebirth, and in the next incarnation become our head, to be joined by the new organism from the mother's body, fertilized by the father, are those of the rest of the body in our last incarnation. At death we lose our head, one may say, insofar as its forces are spent, and we transform the forces of the rest of our organism into the head of our next incarnation. The great mass of modern mankind in their past incarnation despised this earthly veil of tears as it was regarded in Christianity. This disdain is a feeling connected with the whole body, not bound to the head. And as they reincarnate today, what in their last life was a seemingly very lofty Christian sentiment develops the organ of the head, and in doing so is transformed into its opposite, becoming a yearning for matter, a longing for material life. Humanity today has come to a turning point in evolution, where it has to be said very little indeed has entered their head from their former incarnation. And precisely for this reason, it is vital that something new must enter human beings, a revelation of the present, something newly revealed to people from the world of spirit. It is no longer possible today merely to cite the Gospels. Instead, we must hearken to what is being said spiritually to us as humanity. The Catholic Church, for example, also participates in dead thinking of a kind unable to grasp the living organism. In Bern, again, Catholic speakers did not weary of proclaiming Christ as the Son of the living God. But my dear friends, what use is this if we encompass Christ only with dead thinking? That is, if he becomes only a dead ideal in our thoughts. Rather than invoking Christ, the Son of the living God, what we need today is to invoke Christ, the living Son of God. In other words, the Christ who is now alive and working to bring humanity new revelations. It is in this sense that spiritual science, specifically, seeks to find the impulse of all our thinking in the new revelation coming directly from spiritual worlds. But this would give people thoughts capable of fathoming reality. And in many respects, these thoughts would be the very opposite of those that dominate minds today. People today want to cling to the cleverest thoughts, which are, however, as far removed as possible from reality. Once they possess such a thought, they cling to it in an extraordinary manner, not noticing the realities that actually hold sway, and in some circumstances modify thinking. Let me give you a striking instance of this. Like the statesman who spoke of world peace in the spring and summer of 1914, the various, in quotes, international speakers in Bern spoke of the planned League of Nations. As you know, the idea of this League of Nations springs from the head of Woodrow Wilson. In his speech in January 1917, Wilson formulated this idea. He proposed it as something we should aspire to, so as to avoid in future further dire catastrophes, such as those into which we have been driven in modern times. He described this League of Nations as an absolute necessity, at the same time saying that its realization will depend on a specific condition, without which such a league cannot be established. This prerequisite was that the war should end without any side being victorious. For a League of Nations could never be realized, he said, if a decisive victory was gained by one side at the expense of a decisive defeat for the other. Yes, that was the condition which Wilson said was critical to the founding of a League of Nations. And what has now come about is the precise opposite of Wilson's requirement. Yet the hypothetical League, which Wilson described in January 1917, is now going to be founded despite this. This is a prime example of being very far removed from reality in your thoughts, of clinging to an idea without any means of penetrating or engaging with reality, an inability to encompass this reality in your thinking. Yet that is the most essential thing today. People fail to see that they must not stop short in their thoughts, but must use them to perceive and fathom realities. One well-meaning person in Bern was the pacifist Schücking. People were talking about this League of Nations and how its institutions would work. Curiously, it was being said that just as separate countries have parliaments, so we should aspire to an overriding supranational parliament. To the objection that the various nations were independent entities and would therefore not submit to a unified, centralized leadership at a supranational level, Schücking replied that the example of the National Assembly in Weimar showed this was possible. All the little territorial principalities were, he said, likewise independent entities, but they could see the usefulness of an encompassing whole. It is easy to see why people wedded to abstractions might think this. What could be more self-evident than seeing the many small principalities joined together in the National Assembly as an example of something that could be realized on a larger scale with a superstate? But anyone who thinks in real specific terms will go on to ask how this became possible in Weimar. It came about through the German Revolution. Otherwise, it would have been unthinkable. A supranational parliament, modeled on the Weimar National Assembly, could only come about after a world revolution. This is thinking that connects with realities, does not sunder itself from them, and would, if it did, feel itself to be sick and ailing. It is so difficult to make people realize that we need a new thinking, a truly new kind of reality-friendly thinking, and that the healing of our condition will depend on people inclining toward this reality-friendly thinking. but thinking with no interest in the world of spirit cannot fathom reality. For this world of spirit lives in all reality. Those who wish to know nothing about the world of spirit are least able to fathom reality, and will be still less able to in future. Whether or not humanity turns to spiritual scientific knowledge is therefore one of the primary questions today for the healing of our modern world. This has to be the foundation, and could be, can easily be. It is superficial tittle-tattle to keep saying it is so hard to introduce this science of the spirit into the real world that people reject it. Please don't say such things. All that is needed is to abolish state supervision of universities, secondary schools, primary schools. And in 10 years, spiritual science, or at least its necessary and primary foundations, will have replaced our modern soul-ruining and soul-deadening academia. What could already today spring from the emancipated third of the healthy social organism, from the spiritual, cultural sphere, will look very different from what has been superintended by the state, which seeks only to educate its priests to propound a theology acceptable to the state, to educate its jurists as state jurists, not to mention its doctors. The state suppresses any form of medicine not confined within state boundaries, at all costs dismissing as ridiculous a knowledge that aims to heal people wherever they are in the world. As I have often said, socialist thinking regards all spiritual cultural life as ideology. What is the reason for this? Why is all culture, in the thinking of the proletarian masses, seen as an ideology? Well, it is because all knowledge is supposed to be underpinned by something external, by the political state, since it is only the shadow of this political state. It is, indeed, ideology. For spiritual cultural life not to be ideology, it must continually demonstrate its reality through its own powers. That is, it must be emancipated and self-founded. Spiritual life must continually demonstrate its reality, must not have an outer crutch. Only a life of spirit and culture without a crutch, founded only on human capacities and gifts, only self-administering, will be able also to send its currents into capitalism in a healthy way. Capitalist governance is in fact nothing other than one effected by human capacities. If you make spiritual cultural life healthy at its core, it becomes healthy too, where it flows into capitalism and governs economic life. Thus are things connected, in a context we must come to understand. My dear friends, we must avoid all the reality-estranged thinking of those wedded to abstraction, which we meet at every turn, and which has led to our current parlous circumstances. People do not yet recognize this. Nowadays they ask what form the world state should have, thinking that it should be simply modeled on what the state as they know it has been and done so far. But would it not be much wiser to ask what this state should refrain from doing? The states in Europe brought about the catastrophic war, and it is much more self-evident to ask what they should stop doing. They should stop involving themselves in the life of the spirit. They should stop acting as entrepreneurs. They should confine themselves to the political domain alone. We cannot ask how a League of Nations should be founded and base this on what states have done hitherto or should have done. It is better and more topical today to ask what they should refrain from doing. As yet, people are still disinclined to really engage with such things, but the fate of humanity today will depend on whether they do engage with them or not. Today was by way of introduction to these themes, and tomorrow I will speak further about them. The end of Lecture 7.